Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bentley, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Elizabeth Graber Bentley presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. All right, welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 17th, 2024, and today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording that will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. A quick reminder that there are no other recordings permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. This is our last oral argument of the morning. We'll hear one more non-oral case this afternoon. And go ahead, Marshall, if you want to call the next case on the calendar.
Now calling case number A24-0179, Amy Sweezy Tamburino, appellant, versus Michael O. Freeman, respondent, David Huff et al., respondents.
All right, good morning, counsel. Each side will be given 15 minutes. My understanding is that appellant, you'll begin with 15 minutes on the respondents, that the county will take 12 minutes, and counsel for Mr. Freeman, 3 minutes. Is that correct? Great. And then appellant will have another 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please feel free to come up, and please state your name and your client's name for the record.
Good morning. Sonia Miller-Van Oort on behalf of Ms. Amy Sweezy. May it please the court, Ms. Sweezy, a former veteran county prosecutor, reported and then refused to follow directives she believed violated rules of professional conduct. In response, she suffered malicious retaliation, fraudulent trickery, career-changing breaches of her contract, and ultimately constructive discharge. Although the trial court record below was replete with disputed material facts on each of her claims, the trial court improperly granted summary judgment. Ms. Sweezy therefore asked this reviewing court to reverse and remand for trial her claims under the Whistleblower Act, breach of contract, breach of implied covenant, and fraudulent inducement. Beginning this morning, Your Honor, with the whistleblower claim, I'd like to focus the court's attention on particularly the constructive discharge of Ms. Sweezy that occurred under Ms. Moriarty's term. First, the record contained much disputed facts, but in particular, it contained direct evidence linking Ms. Sweezy's protected conduct and Ms. Moriarty's adverse actions. First, on December 29th, 2022, the record shows that her assistant gratuitously sent to her the charge of discrimination that Ms. Sweezy had filed in the past because it might be of interest to Ms. Moriarty. At that time, Ms. Moriarty then read the complaint, which contained information about the protected conduct, here refusing to follow directions that she believed violated law. The disputed facts show that Ms. Moriarty testified that she formed a specific conclusion about that protected conduct when she read the report. At her deposition at 163, she
said— Can I interrupt you there? Is the conduct— the protected conduct you're talking about are is the conduct that was not preempted,
correct,
by the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So what specific protected conduct is still at issue?
The specific protected conduct at issue, Your Honor, is Ms. Sweezy's report to Mr. Freeman and a refusal to follow charging directions that she believed violated ethical rules. That was not preempted and is the subject of what I'm referring to now.
The report in 2020, I believe.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Ms. Banner, just to clarify something, and I'm switching just to the question actually has more to do with the breach of contract claim. Is it true that the constructive discharge is not an element, not a requirement for your client to prove or evidence to be presented? That has to do with the tort claims and
that's correct, Your Honor.
Whistleblower only.
That's correct. The constructive discharge only relates to the Whistleblower Act.
Thank you.
The record, Your Honor, showed—
There have to be a evidence of constructive discharge for her to succeed on her Whistleblower Act?
With regard to the time period for Ms. Moriarty and that part of the whistleblowing claim, there does not have to be a constructive discharge. What she has to show is that the employer is prohibited from threatening, discharging, discriminating, or otherwise penalizing the employee's work condition, terms, and privileges of employment. So no, she wouldn't have to show that, but that is in fact what the record shows here.
So just to clarify, it's not the constructive discharge per se, it's the facts that lead up to what she describes as a discharge constructively, that's the important part of the response to the whistleblower.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And what I want to be clear that is pointed out in the record is that Ms. Moriarty's testimony about her reaction to and conclusions that she drew about that protected conduct at issue was that she concluded that Ms. Sweezy's conduct was about insubordination. And what's important about that, Your Honor, is we understand what insubordination means generally, which is it's a negative, and it means you didn't follow your superior's directions. And that specifically is the conduct, the protected conduct at issue here. The other direct evidence that links that protected conduct in Ms. Moriarty's actions was that less than 40 days after she learned and formed her opinion about this protected conduct, she met with Ms. Sweezy, told her she was being transferred out of her unit, out of any leadership, and out of violent crimes altogether. And during that meeting, Ms. Sweezy asked her, "Why are you doing this to me?" And her response was, "Because of your history and the people involved." And the record shows that during that conversation, that MDHR complaint was also being discussed at the same time. Given those facts in the record, Your Honors, it's clear that not only is there circumstantial temporal evidence, but also this very direct evidence that causes a connection between the conduct at issue, the protected conduct at issue, and then what happened to Ms. Sweezy in the form of adverse action. Moving to the adverse action, which is the constructive discharge, Your Honor, that you were asking about, Henry versus Independent Schools provides the guidance on what needs to be established. And there are two elements. One, that there are objectively intolerable working conditions, and two, that the employer intended to force the employee to quit. Well, here, Your Honors, again, the record was full of evidence on those particular issues. In the record, Ms. Sweezy was at the top of her career. She had been serving the county for 28 years. She had managed the community prosecution unit. She was leading the complex prosecution unit at this time. Then, on February 6, 2023, after Ms. Moriarty learned of the protected conduct and formed an impression about it, she took Sweezy out of her leadership role, and she moved her into a line attorney position within the office. That's an entry-level position in the office, taking assignments from a senior attorney who normally would be the kind of person that Ms. Sweezy would be managing. After that date, she no longer had any supervisory or managerial duties. She didn't manage any team of attorneys or staff. She didn't oversee any assignments. She didn't evaluate others' performance. All of that was stripped from her.
Can I take you back? And I think you addressed this point, but I just want to be really clear about what's in the record. As far as the issue of causation, you point to the comment about insubordination and then Ms. Sweezy's testimony or would be, you know, deposition that she asked why and it was because of her history. Are those the only two points in the decision making point between that Ms. Moriarty had made, you know, in then putting her in this position?
That's generally correct, Your Honor. She read this report, which there was no reason for her to read. She formed a very specific conclusion about it, finding it that was insubordination. There were no performance evaluations or any performance issues from the time that she read that to the time that she transferred her in about 40 days. And during the conversation, she was very direct and specific. She did not say, "I'm doing this for a business reason. I'm doing this because of your performance. I'm doing this for any misconduct." What she said was, "I'm doing this because of your history and the people involved." And that, I think, Your Honor, is enough facts in the record for a jury to reasonably conclude that there's a causal link. All of that information, Your Honor, with regard to her, how she was demoted basically to the bottom of her office from being at the top of her office, is also buttressed by much factual record and testimony by various colleagues.
Can I direct you, actually, I'd like to hear your argument on the breach of contract claim with the county.
Yes.
And
I.
Okay, or did you?
Before we turn
go ahead.
To that, can I ask a question?
Please, yeah, go ahead.
The Whistleblower Act claim. How do those facts about, the working conditions demonstrate that they are objectively intolerable, given that she still was making a salary associated with the principal attorney level and had that title. How is it objectively intolerable given her employment situation?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would say that the facts and the records demonstrate why that's the case. There was testimony from people who worked in the office, including Judge John Schmidt, who testified that Ms. Sweezy was put into a line attorney position and he had never seen a principal attorney relegated to taking assignments from a senior attorney. Ms. Cole testified everybody knew she'd been put out to pasture, was twiddling her thumbs, and I don't know how anybody could assume that anybody could tolerate this for any length of time. Judge Burdorf testified she had never seen anyone who was a manager of one of the divisions and a person so widely respected be put into a job that she was assigned to. Judge Mabley testified that the experience that Ms. Sweezy was put into would seem like a devastating experience. There's all kinds of evidence, Your Honor, showing that.
And it's your view that that's enough that a reasonable employee would have, that that's communicating that you're going under the disparate treatment analysis, correct?
Yeah, I'm relying on Henry with regard to the constructive discharge, yes.
But not the hostile work environment.
Correct.
Discharge.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that also requires that an employer act in a manner so as to have communicated to a reasonable employee that she will be terminated. So what evidence is there of that?
Well, as I read Henry, Your Honor, the first prong, which is showing an objectively intolerable working condition, there's two ways to do that. One is the one that you referred to, which says that there's somehow the employer is communicating to a reasonable employee that she'll be terminated. But the other one discussed in Henry is simply that the conduct is so pervasive or severe that it's a reasonable person would have felt compelled to resign.
Okay.
And the evidence that we present, I believe, gives enough for a jury to be able to reach that conclusion. And then with that second element, that the employee intended to force the employee to quit, again, I think I've presented disputed facts on that issue as well. And I would point even to the Supreme Court case of Muldrow, which really, to your point, Your Honor, the court there said this isn't really about somebody's rank, in that case, rank or pay. But she had been transferred, just like Ms. Sweezy, and I would say Ms. Sweezy's situation is much more egregious, to a completely different low-level type of work that she had not been in as she had built her career up to at that point.
Would your better argument be that she was penalized rather than discharged?
I think that there are both, Your Honor. I think that she was penalized. Her working conditions and privileges of employment were certainly. And I would note that the conduct under a Minnesota Whistleblower Act is less restrictive. It's wider conduct protected than even under the MHRA or Title VII. So I believe that that all fits as well. But the truth is, all of that led to an intolerable condition, which forced her ultimately to resign, as any reasonable person would have in that situation. And we'll move on to the breach of contract claim to address that briefly.
Can I just to start, just to understand your position on this, is it your position that the district court didn't reach this, or would you agree with opposing counsel that it wasn't in the breach of contract part of the decision, but that the court did interpret the agreement and the heart of the breach of contract question in its decision on the implied?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. The court simply ignored this issue and did not rule on this issue.
So is it what relief or would you be asking for then? Would you seek a remand for the district court to reach the breach of contract in the first instance?
I think in the first instance, that's probably the right result. Obviously, she dismissed it. And so if we take the fact that she dismissed it without explaining why she dismissed it and that it's on a de novo review, then I believe that this court can look at it and make the determination on it. I've never seen a case where the judge simply ignored a claim and didn't address it but dismissed it. But I think those are your options. With regard to that breach of contract claim, the contract itself is quite clear in provision one, essential term of this agreement. In fact, it was the first thing negotiated and had to be arrived at before it can move on to the rest of it. Was that it would define what Ms. Sweezy's title, role, and responsibilities would be. And they're all laid out right in section one. She's going to be reclassified as a principal attorney, and she will be entitled to, that's the language, will be entitled to the responsibilities that are outlined. We see those responsibilities specifically outlined in the same provision in A through H, and you can also look at the job specification that lists the same things. But she was entitled to those things. That was a binding term even on the new county attorney. And Ms. Sweezy acknowledged that
slow you down a little bit. You say even on the new county attorney. So if you look at paragraph one, it says that she'll be entitled to pay and responsibilities outlined in the specification. And then there's a new sentence saying that that classification shall continue beyond the end of 2022 subject to the civil service rules of Hennepin County, which I understand is where the, which then incorporates the rule. Is there a difference there? Obviously, I think you would say no, but I want to understand why.
Right. So, I mean, what this says is what her role will be continuing, and paragraph 8 makes it very clear that while other parts of this agreement are not binding on the new county attorney, provision 1, other than the reporting structure, is binding on the new county attorney.
But you know, the civil service rule, so if you look at the class specification plan, I'm looking, I think this is addendum 107, says that, you know, those definitions are descriptive, not restrictive, and then it says it shall not be construed to any extent or in any way, above, you know, or in any way modifying the power of any appointing authority to assign, direct, and control the work of employees. So how do we read that description as in any way binding a new county attorney, you know, when the language says, you know, these responsibilities will stay or whatever until beyond 2022 subject to this rule saying it's not going to be in any way restricting and assigning appointing authorities duties or ability to assign somebody to a different position or different duties.
I see that I'm out of time. May I respond?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So Your Honor, the parties decided in order to resolve a claim what was going to be agreed on. And what was agreed on were the terms that are in this agreement. And the civil service rules didn't change what the parties agreed to. And specifically, even though she could be assigned to a different division, that wouldn't be a problem. But what they agreed to was that she would continue as a principal attorney. The whole point of being a principal attorney was to be safeguarded in that position. And the very first sentence of the spec on that, if we're relying on the spec in any regard, says that the role of a principal attorney is to direct a major division of the county attorney's office. I don't think anything about the civil service rules changes that fact. And the fact is, the disputed facts in the record show, she did not. She was not allowed to direct any major division. She was a line attorney. And on those facts presented in the record, a reasonable jury could certainly conclude that there was a substantial breach of this agreement. Recognizing that I'm out of time.
Yeah, do any of the judges have further questions at this point? Or on the breach or otherwise?
I did have one while Judge Cochran's pondering. So is your point with regard to the, we have to give meaning, of course, to the reference to the civil service rules. Is your point being that, or your argument that the county did not present any evidence of a particular civil service rule that would prohibit it from following this agreement?
Well, that's certainly true, Your Honor. And again, to the extent that the agreement is referring to anything outside of it, under Dunn versus National Beverage, if there's a conflict between the actual agreement and documents that are referenced outside of it, the agreement controls as well. But yes, Your Honor, to your question, I believe that that's true.
Thank you.
I have a question, but I can wait till rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll bring you back for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Rachel Kitsy Collins. I'm an attorney at Lockridge Grindle Nowen, appearing today on behalf of the appellee, Hennepin County. Your Honors, the district court's summary judgment order should be affirmed in its entirety. Each of Ms. Sweezy's claims was dismissed on multiple, independently sufficient grounds, and Ms. Sweezy has offered no compelling reason for this court to disturb the trial court's well-reasoned order. Based on the discussion with appellant's counsel, I want to start with breach of contract, and then I will move to the whistleblower claim. Judge Bentley, you hit on exactly the point here. The contract says that she will be reclassified as a principal attorney, entitled to the pay and responsibilities in the job class spec, and that the classification shall continue subject to the civil service rules of Hennepin County. Both the job class specification and civil service rules are expressly incorporated by reference into the contract, and both are clear that the job duties are not exclusive or restrictive, and they do not in any way modify the power of the county attorney to assign, direct, and control the work of employees. Nothing in the contract, or the civil service rules, or the job class specification guarantees that Ms. Sweezy would retain a manager role in the new administration.
Well, the agreement does say in paragraph 4, though, that she can be reassigned as long as her assignments are consistent with the duties of a principal attorney, and paragraph 1 outlines the duties of a principal attorney. So doesn't that language require that if she is reassigned, you know, at the direction of a new county attorney, that her new assignment duties be consistent with the duties of principal attorney as listed in this agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. A couple responses to that. First, paragraph 8 says that paragraphs 2 through 6 shall not be binding on the new county attorney, so it's questionable whether that paragraph even survives beyond 2022. And second, there are undisputed facts in the record that she was performing some of the responsibilities of a principal attorney in her new position. Her former boss, Dan Madeley, testified that the type of work she was doing substantively was the type of work he expected a principal attorney to be doing. She was also scheduled to teach in the trial school, fulfilling paragraph F of the principal attorney roles. She was continued to be involved in discussions about how the office handled Brady issues, fulfilling paragraph B and policy issues. There's nothing.
Recognizing that evidence, we're here on summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And there is evidence in the form of her declaration and deposition testimony, as well as deposition testimony from John Schmidt that, she at least in her declaration states that she wasn't performing any of the responsibilities identified in the list of duties for a principal attorney. There's also some deposition testimony going to that. So is there a disputed issue of material fact in that regard?
No, Your Honor. She doesn't specifically rebut the evidence in the record that she was performing at least some of the roles. Her argument here is that she was entitled to a permanent manager position. That is simply not what the job class specification, the civil service rules, or the contract say. She is essentially trying to use the other terms of the contract, her leading of the CPU, et cetera, to inform her reading of paragraph 1, but none of those terms survived beyond 2022. Furthermore, Your Honors, It is undisputed that.
Can I just clarify that, though? As I'm reading that, she will be entitled to pay and responsibilities outlined in the county job classification. Sweezy's classification as a principal attorney shall continue beyond the end of 2022, and then it goes on to be subject to the civil service rules. So, where either in this agreement or the civil service rules does it say it will end your eligibility to be a principal attorney upon a new county attorney?
Your Honor, she was still a principal attorney. A principal attorney is a job classification that entitles you to a specific level of pay, protects you from termination without cause.
But doesn't that also get to the job duties that we were talking about, that there's factual disputes that she's not doing those job duties?
Your Honor, the class specifications under the civil service rules are specifically limited. They are declared to have the following force and effect. And it says they do not in any way modify the power of an appointing authority to assign, direct, and control the work of employees.
But doesn't
she
the
has
settlement,
no entitlement to any of those particular
Doesn't the settlement agreement itself set the terms of their agreement, not the civil service rules?
You
or
have
to the extent, as
yeah.
counsel was pointing out, there might be some ambiguity or some confusion between the two. Wouldn't the settlement agreement, as a matter of contract law, be the document that answers the question?
Well, as a matter of contract law, Your Honor, you have to read paragraph one as a whole. And paragraph one doesn't say that job duties shall include the following. It just says job duties include, which is exactly the language in the job class specification. And it also explicitly incorporates the civil service rules, which, again, don't limit the power of the county attorney.
What do you make of the language in the civil service rules? It's at the end of that subparagraph A that's, you know, it says it doesn't limit the appointing authorities, the power of an appointing attorney to assign, blah, blah, which we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And then it says the use of a particular expression or illustration as to duties shall not be held to exclude others not mentioned that are of a similar kind or quality. That you know, reads somewhat like, you know, it's not saying that you have to give these exact duties or the all eight listed, but at least things that are like those things. So that you, the job implies that you're doing something that looks like a managerial or a principal attorney role as outlined in those. Maybe it's not those exact ones, but it's implied that the person would be performing duties like those.
What? I disagree with that interpretation. You know, the first sentence says the definitions are descriptive. So I think that the last sentence is just bolstering the fact that these duties don't exclude others, right? That one thing can mean multiple types of duties.
Could somebody be a principal attorney, even under the civil service rules, if they performed none of the eight listed duties in the classification?
Your Honor, it's hard to imagine how those civil service rules could be written any more broadly. So I would say, yes, that is possible, but you don't need to reach that issue here because she was performing at least some of the roles, and she was offered the ability to perform others. She was told that she could be managing people in the future, and Ms. Moriarty initially intended to offer her a role managing a new worker protection unit. When Ms. Sweezy indicated that she had absolutely no interest in doing that, Ms. Moriarty changed direction and assigned her to just work on complex economic crimes. But Ms. Sweezy shouldn't be able to argue she was stripped of her roles when she was given new opportunities and declined to take advantage of them because she thought the work was beneath her.
I was going to switch to the Whistleblower Act.
Thanks. Do either of you have any
Other
questions of contract? Could you turn to the Whistleblower Act claim?
Sure. Can I make one last point about breach of contract? And that is, it was also dismissed on the basis that she has no damages. She did not suffer any change in pay by virtue of her reassignment, so she has no damages arising from her alleged breach of contract.
Well, just to let me ask you a question about that then. She, you know, alleges, or at least with a breach of contract claim, we can, the court would consider consequential damages as well as general damages, right? So why wouldn't the consequential damages of a breach like this, assuming there's a breach, right, before we're getting to damages, and she, in fact, was no longer a principal attorney under the rules, wouldn't it be foreseeable that she would resign such that those would be consequential damages?
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor. There is no case permitting constructive discharge as a companion claim to a breach of contract.
But it's not constructive discharge, right? This is just...
Well, there's no case permitting that allows an employee to resign and take and claim front pay arising from a breach of contract. The employee has to be terminated in violation of a breach of contract in order to claim front pay.
But and what about the general standard for damages, those that are naturally but not necessarily occurring and reasonably foreseeable?
Your Honor, again, her change in position did not cause her any economic damages. She chose to resign and has claimed constructive discharge with respect to her whistleblower claim, but there's no case allowing that decision to resign to be tied back to a breach of contract.
Is there any case, I guess, that would prohibit or says that such damages could not be awarded or would be inappropriate? I mean, maybe we don't have a specific case on hand that says front pay is a consequential damage of a breach of contract claim where someone later resigned. We don't have that. Maybe we don't have that exact case, but is there a case saying that that would be an inappropriate way to measure damages?
I don't have a case for that.
All right.
And so a jury could, the fact finder, I'm sorry, I just
go.
Could find that it was a consequence of the breach of the contract, that therefore she left, or her career status and so forth have been affected, and that's a cost, that's a damage.
Well, I still disagree. I think that if she wanted to claim breach of contract with respect to this issue, she needed to stay in the role and claim specific performance. She can't claim consequential damages in terms of front pay. With the whistleblower claim.
And what case would you rely on to support that she needed to seek specific performance instead of monetary damages?
Well, Your Honors, the case that plaintiff relies on is Feggies v. Perkins. In that case, the employee was actually terminated.
Correct.
I don't have a case going the other way, but
okay.
I would say there is no case allowing constructive discharge. With respect to the whistleblower claim, Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record connecting Ms. Sweezy's withdrawal from the Chauvin case in June of 2020, to Moriarty's decision 2.5 years later to reassign her to work on complex economic crimes. Ms. Moriarty's reading of the charge alone did not put her on notice of that conduct. The charge does not contain any details of Ms. Sweezy's withdrawal from the situation, and furthermore is a charge under the Human Rights Act and was related to gender discrimination. It doesn't even say that this is a whistleblower claim. There's also no evidence in the record that Moriarty had any independent knowledge of the circumstances of Ms. Sweezy's withdrawal. She never spoke to Freeman about it. She never spoke to Matthews about it. And she wasn't even sure the basis for Ms. Sweezy's disagreement with Mr. Freeman. Causation is simply too attenuated.
So again, on summary judgment, it seems as though if this, were to be before a jury, that they could weigh that. What did she know? What did she draw from reading the complaint? There's testimony, or at least counsel for Ms. Sweezy points out the conversation where she said, because of your history. So why on summary judgment, especially when we're viewing the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Sweezy, would that not be sufficient to at least establish a material fact?
Your Honor, the reference to Ms. Moriarty's testimony is taken out of context. The insubordination she referred to was related to Ms. Sweezy's, the fact that Ms. Sweezy signed the initial complaint against Derek Chauvin that charged him with a lesser degree of crime. That was all Moriarty knew about. She did not know about Ms. Sweezy's disagreement with Mr. Freeman about charging the other three officers. There's no facts to rebut those specific facts showing that Moriarty did not have any specific knowledge of the conduct. So there can be no causation. I see I'm out of time. Happy to answer.
Well, let me just see if I had another question. Can you address the standard that we're looking at with the whistleblower claim? It's been briefed in the context of disparate treatment or some of what, in that context, but I'm wondering, looking at the text of the statute, which just talks about penalize, is something Judge Cochran brought up earlier, which seems to be much broader than requiring, what we might in an employment discrimination suit. Can you talk, just to point you to the language, it says, describes penalize, or defines penalize in the statute as something that might dissuade a reasonable employee from making a report.
Your Honor, I have never understood plaintiff to be making anything less than a constructive discharge claim with respect to the 2023 time period. And constructive discharge has an incredibly high standard. You have to either show an aggravated case of a hostile work environment, which Sweezy does not meet here, or you have to show constructive discharge based on disparate treatment, which requires the plaintiff to show that the employer communicated to her that she would be terminated, or the employer essentially wants or expects her to quit.
So I know that she just made that argument during her time. So could you address? Are you suggesting that it's forfeited to frame it in that way, or how? If we're interpreting the statute, I just want to understand your point, because I heard her just making that point, that the idea of somebody being penalized under the definition of the statute is something that they're raising. So could you address that argument?
I have never seen that argument raised in the briefs, so I believe it's forfeited. With respect to the 2023 time period, it has always been a constructive discharge claim. So I would say that it has been waived on appeal.
Okay. And, all right. Anybody?
But with respect to Freeman, it's not waived.
With respect to Freeman, she alleges different types of adverse employment actions, which the district court found did not rise to the level of an adverse employment action. But no, she did not allege constructive discharge with respect to the 2022 time period. And
in your
perhaps
view, yeah.
Mr. Freeman's lawyer can address the 22 time period.
Okay.
Thank you. The county respectfully requests the court affirm the district court's order.
Thank you for your argument. Okay. Counsel for Mr. Freeman.
Your Honors, Mary Knobloch of the Maslin Law Firm, representing respondent former Hennepin County Mike Freeman in connection with the individual claims brought by appellant. Appellant challenges only three of the district court's summary judgment rulings with respect to Mr. Freeman, and we've allocated just 3 minutes of our time to address any questions you may have relating to those rulings, and then I can just briefly address 3 points that I want you to keep in mind when reviewing those particular claims. First, Mr. Freeman's summary judgment motion was based on a narrow set of undisputed facts. There are many, many facts in this record alleged, but his summary judgment motion was based on a very narrow set of undisputed facts. Every record cite included in his summary judgment brief stands for what it says literally. We highlighted the deposition testimony submitted to emphasize this. All of it's attached to my declaration in the record. It's document number 169 with some exhibits attached to 170 and 171. The same cannot be said to appellant's citations to the record. In the district court as well as here at the Court of Appeals, appellant's citations to the record do not support the statements that are made. That's my first point. The record stated by Mr. Freeman is the record literally, and that is the record on which the district court ruled in favor of him on the individual claims against him in this case. My second point, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Fundamental to that claim is that it be connected to an underlying contract. This court recently affirmed that in a 2024 published opinion cited in our briefing, Metropolitan Transportation Network, Inc. versus Collaborative Student Transportation of Minnesota. Appellant presses this court to adopt Section D to Section, Comment D to Section 205 of the Restatement Second of Contracts. That comment reports that some courts have in some states construed the implied covenant to go beyond what is in Minnesota law and include something called the, quote, invasion of the spirit of the bargain, end quote. As the district court held, the Minnesota Supreme Court has not adopted that part of the restatement in statute or case law. That's on page 24 of the district court's opinion. And it would be beyond this error-correcting role of this court to do so on this appeal.
Can I ask you a quick question just about trying to understand our case law here? It says, we have case law, I think it's the Inree Hennepin County case, that says that, talks about how you need unjustifiable hindrance of performance. But it talks about, it focuses really on what is, not going beyond the scope of the underlying contract. And I guess I'm wondering, what does that mean? Because it doesn't require an express breach. So even here, if we're not talking about an express breach of contract, why is the conduct alleged here not, or still within the scope of the agreement?
So the conduct alleged here, for example, the reassignment of other attorneys, Ms. Sweezy's colleagues, to the principal attorney classification. There's nothing in the contract, in the settlement agreement, that bound Mr. Freeman whatsoever with respect to the reclassification of other attorneys. That's beyond the scope of the contract. That cannot be a breach of an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. With respect to the allegations about staffing of the CPU and case assignments of the CPU, there's the claims here are that Mr. Freeman was prohibited from talking to someone else about the CPU. By the way, the record is very clear. There is evidence of three conversations that Mr. Freeman had with individuals about the staffing of the CPU, none of which had any impact upon the staffing of the CPU. So in terms of the breach of the covenant and implied fair dealing, you need to look at what they're saying. They're saying he couldn't say anything to anyone about the staffing of the CPU. The contract does not say that. The contract...
But I guess that's my question, or just what I'm trying to understand here is the difference between, let's say I agree that there was no breach of contract on that. The contract didn't say you can't speak to anybody, but as I understand the argument is that this is... in evading the spirit of the contract by interfering with the staffing, that still falls within the scope of the agreement in its kind of spirit or broad sense. So sure. Tell me, maybe that's not, and I can, ask appellant this on rebuttal, but sure. I'm just trying to understand.
Just to be clear, there's no Minnesota Supreme Court that adopts the evasion of the spirit language. Nowhere. And in fact, the Court of Appeals has said we are not adopting that, and that would not be appropriate for this court to do that. The language of the case law is that, it requires that one party not unjustifiably hinder the other party's performance of the contract. So with the staffing of the CPU and the case assignments, in the contract, Dan Mabley was responsible for staffing. He was responsible for case assignments. He testified unequivocally, Mr. Freeman did not interfere or unjustifiably hinder me fulfilling my obligations under that contract. That's the evidence in the record. That's the standard for the contract, for the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim. So I think the appellant is trying to go with this invasion of spirit of the language that is not the case law in Minnesota. And I think the district court sets that out pretty clearly in those sections of her opinion and appropriately applies the case law on that. I may be out of time, but if you...
Can you address the Whistleblower Act claim and in my reading of appellant's brief with regard to Mr. Freeman, there is an argument that the conduct imposed on Sweeney by Freeman would likely dissuade a reasonable employee from blowing the whistle. And so would you agree on that claim with respect to Freeman that the issue is whether the conduct was such that it was penalizing the employee?
So that claim is not individually against Mr. Freeman.
So is that claim still alive in your view? Counsel for the county was focused on the, period when after Moriarty became the county attorney. What is the current... is that claim still viable as it relates to the period when Freeman was in office? Or not viable, that's not the right word, but is that claim on appeal, are we reviewing that period when Freeman was in office as well?
So just to be clear, that's not a claim individually against my client.
Right, I understand, but so the attorney it's against, for the county yes. suggested that you could answer the question.
So what I would... suggest is that the court carefully look at the allegations made about Mr. Freeman's conduct. It's not supported by the allegations that are set out in that brief. Mr. Freeman had no contact literally no contact, very little contact, I should say. I think he had one conversation with Ms. Sweezy after the settlement agreement was signed. And the other, there's a fair amount of gossip, hearsay in this record that does not tie or link anything to his conduct, such that that would be the basis for any kind of a whistleblower claim on behalf of the, against the county for his actions.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate you answering it because the county attorney, or the attorney for the county had suggested that you might be able
understand.
To answer the question.
So. But I again,
yeah,
I think
the
record.
And I do understand that the only claims related to Freeman are the implied covenant claim and the fraud and inducement.
Correct,
claim.
Yeah. Yeah, just to be clear, I mean, the record of what happened between April 19th when the settlement agreement was signed and all claims were released, obviously, up until April 19th, any connection between Ms. Sweezy and Mr. Freeman until he left office in early January of 2023 was extremely limited. And he had little to do with what she was doing pursuant to the contract. As you can see, under the contract, Mr. Mabley was supervising her and managing her. So I just want to make that clear. He lived up to everything he was supposed to do under that contract.
Judge Slater.
Thank you. Ms. Knobloch, I think I, from your briefing, I know the answer to this question, but I want to make sure that I understood it correctly in terms of the fraudulent inducement. It seemed like the chief argument you make for us to affirm is that there's no evidence in the record of any special information or knowledge or decision-making or anything that would give rise to elevating these other attorneys to principal attorney, and therefore there's no evidence of a reasonable reliance on that because she, in her own testimony, indicated she specifically didn't tell them about that, didn't negotiate it because it would have been rejected. Is that a fair summary of the crux of your argument on that claim?
I would say yes. The general principle that applies to this is that a party to a transaction has no duty to disclose material facts to the other. So then you have to, there are some special circumstances that may create a special duty. So appellant has to show that Mr. Freeman had one of these special duties and that's set out in the client case. But she seeks to show a special duty under the prong B of that case. To prove that prong B, she has to have evidence that Mr. Freeman knew that she was operating under a delusion that she would be the only principal attorney for 8 months or forever, and that his silence had actually caused that delusion. There literally is no evidence in the record of that because Ms. Sweezy intentionally did not negotiate that and that she would be the only principal attorney. And she testified in her deposition that she never sought and never bargained for that because she knew the county would never agree to it. Based on that undisputed evidence, Ms. Sweezy cannot show that there was a special duty under the law. Thank you for your time. I respectfully request that the district court summary judgment in Mr. Freeman's favor be affirmed. Thank you,
counsel.
All right, there are several points to hit upon. I will try to do so as swiftly as I can. With regard to the contract claim, it's our position that Section 1, to the extent the language says she is entitled to, that governs what she is entitled to, and it's laid out there. With regard to the question that was asked about damages.
Can I ask about paragraph 8?
Yes. Yes.
So paragraph 8 provides that the provisions in paragraphs 2 through 6, as well as the reporting relationship specified in paragraph 1, are not and cannot be binding on the next county attorney. What does that mean in terms of your breach of contract claim?
It means that paragraph 1 is binding, and it means that it says specifically what she is entitled to as a principal attorney, and it means that the facts show that she was not she was no longer entitled to that after February 6th.
But the language that in paragraph 4 is not binding on the new county attorney. the next county attorney regarding that the assignments, the duties of the assignment be consistent with the duties of a principal attorney.
Regardless of the consistent with language, she was no longer after February 6th a principal attorney with the duties that are identified in section 1. So even if a paragraph 4 didn't apply, it's a little bit baffling to me that the argument here by the other side in all of this in a settlement agreement that was negotiated was that the whole intent was for her to have protection in that role going forward. And the argument that you're hearing today is we didn't actually mean that. We didn't. That's not what it said.
The county makes the point, the argument that the record shows she was, in fact, and I guess this is without any material dispute of fact, performing at least some of those duties. Do you dispute that?
Yeah.
Was she performing none of the 8 duties?
The disputed factual record, Your Honor, has testimony both by Ms. Sweezy and by Judge Schmidt. Judge Schmidt testified she was not acting as a principal attorney. Ms. Sweezy's testimony is she was doing none of those duties. It's a disputed fact, Your Honor. With regard to the consequential damages question that you asked, I would point to 2 things. Yes, it would be a natural and consequence that she would no longer have a job. The Feigs case that we pointed to is helpful on that point. That's this court's opinion in 92, in which it said the appropriate damage consideration related to contractual employment terms, which is what we're talking about here, resulting in a wrongful discharge is the compensation the contract would have allowed if it had been carried out. It's not exactly the situation, but I think it's pretty close and would apply here. I would also reference the Loppy case, which is an older case, which is speaking about specific performance. Obviously, specific performance was not an option here in this case. And under that law, if that's not available, then pecuniary damages are allowed. Moving on to the MWA claim, I just want to point out the charge, you can look in the record, specifically discuss the whistleblowing conduct. There is lots of unlawful conduct mentioned in that charge, but there is a paragraph specifically dedicated to speaking about that whistleblowing charge. So to take the position that Ms. Moriarty did not know about that completely contradicts the record, and it contradicts her testimony. I'd refer you to pages 158, 163 to 173, where I specifically examined her on that protected conduct and the response that I've already explained to the court. Just to clarify, Judge Cochran, yes, in fact, what is on appeal is not just the constructive discharge and conduct that she experienced in 23, but also the conduct she experienced in retaliation with regard to the time that Mr. Freeman was still in office in 2022. There has been no waiver. We have argued throughout this case.
Thank you for that, and I didn't ask the question very well when I asked it to Ms. Knobloch. But with regard to the waiver issue, have you waived, is the argument that appellant makes with regard to 2023 an argument of constructive discharge, has that been your argument from the beginning, as I think was argued by counsel for the county? Have you ever argued that anything in the alternative, such as whether she was penalized for that time period?
I see my time is about to go. May I respond?
Yeah.
Yes. I would disagree that there has been any waiver. It has been argued throughout this case that this conduct, and when the complaint was amended to include then the constructive discharge that included, all of the conduct was identified as violating the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. So I think it's overstepping to say that constructive discharge is the only way that the facts could be viewed by a jury and that we've not waived anything on that, Your Honor. I know that I'm out of time, so I don't know if I have any chance to respond to the comments made by Mr. Freeman's counsel.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case has been submitted, and the court will issue a decision within the time prescribed by the statute.